Well, good morning. So as promised, before I get started, I probably should tell you about my face. So yesterday, Jack and I, after dinner, it was a really beautiful evening, and we decided to take a little scooter ride. And he's actually, I feel bad for Jack, I swear. When he goes to school on Monday, they're going to ask him whether his parents have been beating him. Because he already had his left foot, I think it is in a soft, or I guess a hard cast, but not a permanent cast, one of those booties. Because last week he woke up in the middle of the night complaining of foot pain. So the next morning we went to the doctor, and it turns out he has this thing called Kohler's disease, which is not really a disease. It just means there's one little bone in his foot that's not getting enough blood. And so we've got to rest it, and it'll go away in a few weeks or a few months, and it's no big deal at all. So all that is to say, he's been on crutches for the last week. So yesterday, he and I decided after dinner to go take a little scooter ride. So I put him on the front of my scooter, and you know, we scooted off and went all around the park and around the great lawn and by the castle, and we saw the cherry blossoms, which he's been learning about in school, and it was so great. But then, on the way home, as we're cruising along, 72nd Street, we had just crossed Park Avenue. I hit this, slippery little patch of pavement and just did like a major face plant into the sidewalk, which is great. Just amazing. But the really funny thing about it, and this is just seems so typical of the Upper East Side, is that this very nicely put together middle-aged woman and her son, who's probably about 10 or 11, stopped to help us. And, you know, Jack is crying, and I'm just, you know, bleeding profusely by the face. And so as she's, yeah, it's just great. She says, buddy, you're in rough shape. But as she's digging through her purse to try to find something to help me, like a tissue or a Kleenex or whatever, she says, well, I have it right here. It's a little gross, but I'll show it to you anyway. It's right here. So she pulls out this thing, and I'll just preface this by saying that my son Jackson goes to this all-boys school, this K-8 school called Buckley here on the Upper East Side, and their major rival is St. Bernard's, which is up at 98th Street. And she says, well, I have something here, but I just really hope that you're not a Buckley family, because all I have is a St. Bernard's napkin. And I looked at her, I said, that is hilarious, because we are a Buckley family. I said, get out of here. No, I didn't. But I mean, that to me is ridiculous. Like, that's just the funniest thing ever. I hope you're not a Buckley family, because all I have is a St. Bernard's napkin. But she was very kind, and we got home, and as Jack and I were taking a bath to get ourselves cleaned up, he looked at me and said, Dad, you really look kind of tough. I said, that's right, I do. So, I think as someone said, I'm definitely way more intimidating than I was before, which is what I'm going for here. So, all that aside, what I really want to talk about today, and really what else am I going to talk about, it's Easter, is Jesus' resurrection from the dead, him coming back to life after the crucifixion. And really, there's really only two questions. And to me, one of them is more interesting than the other. But I at least want to briefly address the first one. So the first question is, did it actually happen? And the second question is, if it did happen, what does it mean? And like I said, the first question is actually, you know, there's nothing I can do to convince you that it did or didn't happen. You know, lots of people have tried to write lengthy proofs or come up with theories about why maybe it didn't happen or it did happen. And at the end of the day, the bottom line is that you're only ever, and this is true for me too, you only ever really believe something that you want to believe. And so what I really want to talk about is why it matters that Jesus came back from the dead. But just real briefly, in about 30 seconds, what I will say is that to me, the most compelling proof that it actually happened are two things. One of them is that here in Jesus, we are talking about a guy who had a 3-year public ministry. He spent more time in sort of the public spotlight than we spent in college. And he never wrote a book, and he never had any money, and he never led an army, and he never held any sort of public office. And yet today, he is the most famous, revered, adored person in the history of the world. In a lot of ways, he's the fulcrum of history. And to me, unless he was who he said he was, I just don't quite see how that happens. I mean, compare him to any other great religious leader, and that's just not the case. Second thing that makes me think it actually happened is that after he died and supposedly rose again, which of course I believe, these 11 guys, remember Judas went out and, you know, himself because he felt so bad about what he'd done. But these 11 guys who were fishermen, and tax collectors and uneducated and basically sort of scum of the earth, went about starting a movement that within the space of three centuries had completely taken over the Roman Empire. And all of that in spite of the fact that they were being savagely persecuted the entire time. I mean, do you realize that the Emperor Nero in the first century used to use Christians to light his gardens? He would set them on fire at night in his gardens in Rome. And yet it just grew and it grew and it grew and it grew. And as we know today, you know, look at all the different cults that have come along in our day, the Branch Davidians or Heaven's Gate or any one of these things. When the leader dies, what happens? The sheep scatter. And yet that's not what happened with those disciples. And all of them either went to their death or went to banishment because they refused to say that he did not come back from the dead. They refused. All they would have to say is, we made it up. We'll show you the body. We made it up. It was all a big hoax, but they didn't. So maybe it actually happened. That's all I'm going to say about that. That was a little more than 30 seconds. I apologize. But here's what I really want to talk about, which is, why does it matter? Who really cares if he came back from the dead? What is so special about Jesus? What is so unique about Jesus? And as we think about this question, I want to crib a little bit one of my favorite sort of priests or pastors, theologian, author, professor buddies, who I've never met because he died in 1928. But his name is Karl Hull. He was the rector of the University of Berlin in the early 20th century and a Christian, and he was an expert in comparative religions. And he wrote this wonderful little book, which you have to get. We'll have it, you know, when we actually are a real church. We'll have copies here, and I'll give them to you for free, called The Distinctive Elements in Christianity. The Distinctive Elements in Christianity. And what he actually starts off saying is a little bit arresting. What he says is that there's actually a lot of things about Jesus that aren't unique. He wasn't the first person to claim to be God. He wasn't the first person to claim to be the Messiah. He wasn't the first sort of great moral teacher. Or even things like, if any of you have taken a comparative religion class in college, specifically with someone who's really sort of anti-Christian, you'll learn that lots of different religious traditions and myths had gods who actually died and rose again. And some of them were even born of virgins. And in some of them, in some of these religious traditions, there was even talk about being born again or being born anew. So that all these things that we think are sort of distinctive to Christianity actually turn out not to be so distinctive. Now, of course, Hull makes the point that a lot of these myths, that's what they were. They were stories. Whereas what we're saying about Jesus is that it actually happened. But you could make the case, if you wanted to, that somehow, you know, those older religious traditions got woven into Christianity and it's all just sort of it's a repackaging of what has come before. You could make that argument. So then Hull set about asking the question, what is distinctive about Christianity? What is distinctive about who Jesus was and what he said and what he did and the kind of God that he talked about and the kind of God that he claimed to be? And that really is the central question I want to talk about today. So can we put the first slide up? Here's what Paul says. I begin with what is best known and least doubtful, with that item in the teaching of Jesus which struck his kinsfolk most strongly, and which in fact must have excited the greatest surprise. Jesus is called by his opponents, note, the friend of publicans and sinners. And publican is another word for a tax collector, which is another word for a traitor or cheat or liar or, Bernie Madoff, basically. So the friend of tax collectors and sinners. And he frankly accepts the title. Jesus preaches a God who wants to have dealings with sinful men and women, a God to whom he who has sunk deep stands in certain circumstances, especially near. And this is what Hull wants to say is the distinctive element of Christianity, namely that Jesus was the friend of sinners. He was the friend of sinners, that he talked about and acted like the kind of God who loved people who were not good, who couldn't get their act together, who kept on sinning and sinning and sinning. Jesus was a friend to those people. Remember, he hung out with prostitutes and tax collectors and Roman soldiers. And, you know, we hear that. And to some degree, that has become such a cliche that we forget how radical it is. And we have to sort of put it into our own day and our own time and ask ourselves the question, how would we feel if a guy like Jesus came back today and decided that he wanted to hang out with guys like Bernie Madoff? Because Madoff is really just a latter-day Zacchaeus. You know that story, little Zacchaeus who cheated all the people? That's Bernie Madoff. Or how would we feel if he wanted to start, you know, a little Bible study for a bunch of AIG execs? You know, how would we feel if he went to drug dealers or child molesters or pimps and treated them as if they were loved and forgiven by God? We would be totally scandalized, right? And not just that, but it seems that the people who were actually the most righteous, who were the most religious, the sort of holy people of his day, those were the people with whom Jesus had the most issue, and those were also the people who took the most issue with Jesus, because he just didn't quite fit into the way that they saw the world. And the same thing for us. He doesn't quite fit into the way that we see the world. He was completely radical, and he said something unlike anyone before him or since him has ever said. Can you go to the next quote from Carl Hull? Here's what he also says. He says, if we treat Christianity under the common name of redemption religion, which it is, you know, we are redeemed, we're bought back, we must add that in it, a conception of salvation of quite a distinctive sort emerges. In all the other doctrines of salvation, the belief in liberation and in salvation, redemption, is founded on the conviction of the ineradicable nobility of mankind. In other words, that we're good. Or on some metaphysical likeness of the soul of God. In other words, you know, we need to discover our God consciousness. You know, that sort of talk. The God-like in man must come into its own. Jesus, however, instead of this, sees a deep gulf between God and man. According to him, salvation consists rather in this, that God, of his free grace, comes down to meet man. With Jesus, stress is laid on the fact that man has forfeited his worth, but that God nevertheless accepts him. And as we think about that, I guess the first thing that comes to my mind is, have you ever felt like you forfeited your worth? Have you ever felt worthless? I mean, another word would be demeaned or devalued or degraded. I mean, all of us at some point have felt that. Maybe you even feel that way this morning. Like, I have no idea what, you know, you guys did last night, but maybe you're dealing with that even right now. And the distinctive thing about Jesus is that unlike any other religion or philosophical framework or anything which says, you know, it's up to you to get your act together. It's up to you to rise above. It's up to you to sort of follow the rules or achieve nirvana or achieve some sort of karmic state or even, you know, appease the gods, which I got to tell you, I read this New Yorker article this week, which is fascinating, talking about a hedge fund manager who manages a sort of a nonprofit for hedge funders. And he said what he really likes to go is go hit up guys when they've just built a new house. Because he says, give me something because then it will sort of bless this thing that you've just built. And if that is not appeasing the gods, I don't know what is. You know, so paganism is alive and well in our day. But in contrast to any other system of religion, Jesus doesn't say you need to get your act together for me to be your friend. He says, I am your friend and I love you and I accept you right where you are at this very moment. And no one has ever said anything like that before. And actually, you know what, this is, as part of this, is kind of insulting, actually. Because what Jesus first says, before he says, I love you, is he says, you are not a good person. You're not a good person. And that sort of breaks down all these things we want to believe about ourselves. We try so hard to sort of live in denial or think that we are good people. And that was part of the Pharisees' problem, is they thought they were good. They were getting it done. And so this whole Jesus message of, you are not good, and God loves you anyway, they couldn't quite get over the hump at the first part. And yet to those of us who know that we're not good, it's incredibly comforting. But there's also something else that I think rubs us the wrong way sometimes, and that is that it seems this message of Jesus, the friend of sinners, seems incredibly unfair. It seems totally unfair. I remember having a conversation with a member of my family in which he was, and he had grown up in the church, but he said to me, you know, he said, RJ, my feeling is that there's certain things that you could do, like murder or, you know, rape or something like that, that once you do that, it's over for you. It's done. You know, there's no hope. It's finished. Game over. You know, and I said to him, well, I said, I can understand where you're coming from, but the Christian message is actually that Jesus takes all that upon himself and that there's always forgiveness in him. And he turned and said, that just can't be right. That cannot be right because you know what? That's not natural. That's unnatural. And I had to say, you know what? You're right. It's totally unnatural. It's completely unnatural. And yet, that is why it's so good. That's why it's so good, because it goes counter to everything we believe. And last Carl Hull quote, just a short one. Here's what he says. He says, surely Jesus' conception of God was new. He dealt a blow at everything that earnest ethical thinking, i.e. natural thinking, about the relation between God and man had established, and everything that the common sense understanding of mankind down to the present day has held to be the only right standard. And what he's basically saying is that, of course, if you ask anyone on the street about what God wants, they say he wants you to be a good person. Good people go to heaven, bad people go to hell, right? And if you want to get closer to God, you'd be good. And if you're bad, you know, God may not want to associate with you. And again, Jesus says, no, I am the friend of sinners. And this is why Easter matters, because if he didn't rise, this incredible message isn't true. And you know, part of us, we want really badly to be true. We are dying for this message to be true. You know, when we wake up in the morning and we're kind of ashamed of what we've done the night before, or when we've done something unethical at work and we're scared of getting caught, or when we've said something to someone we love that we know how wrong it was. Or not just that. I mean, only you guys know, and only I know, you know, what sort of we do behind closed doors, you know, when no one is looking. And that fills us with some fear and some shame and some guilt. But the reality is that Jesus says, I see that too. I see it. And I'm still your friend. I'm still your friend. I'm still for you. And the essence of Christianity is that God is for us, even when we are against him. Even when we reject him. Even when we don't believe in him, or we're not sure if we believe in him, or we're not even sure if we want to believe in him. In Jesus, God says, I am for you. And that's the amazing thing about Easter, is that Jesus takes everything we can possibly dish out. I mean, we killed the guy with pain and suffering and torture, and yet he comes back new and fresh, and he says, in spite of all that, I love you, and I forgive you, and I'm your friend. And if God's love in Jesus can overcome murder of himself, there's nothing it can't overcome. There's nothing it can't overcome. And just one more thing, and then I'll wrap up. So much of the time, I think the way we live, and this is true for myself as well, we live believing that God has kind of mixed emotions about us. You know, that as Paul says, St. Paul says, he says that his word is both sort of yes and no. You know, I love you, but I really wish you were different. I accept you for now, but I'm kind of hoping you'll get better. And part of that is because we can't accept ourselves as we are. And we probably had parents, obviously, who, you know, if we're honest, we're a little bit that way too. Like, I love you, and yet it'd be great if you brought home a better report card. Or if you weren't dating him or her. Or if you hadn't married him or her. Or if you came to visit a little more often. You know, that's what we get from our parents. That's what we get from the world. And yet what Paul says is that in Jesus, all the promises of God are yes. There's no more yes and no. All the promises of God are yes. And God is no longer sort of just tolerating you or kind of disappointed in you and wishing that you were better. God isn't waiting for you to kind of, you know, get your act together, or say, you know, okay, I'll accept you for now, I'll give you a few years, then we'll reevaluate. You know, that's not what God is saying. God is saying in Jesus, you are a mess. You are a mess. And I love you anyway. And that's why it matters. That's what Easter's about. That's why it matters that he rose from the dead. Because no one else is saying that. Would you guys pray with me? Lord, I thank you so much for this incredible message that you are the friend of sinners, that you are our friend even when we cannot get our act together. And I pray that that knowledge and that love would sink deep within our heart, Lord, and that it would give us peace and hope and joy on this Easter day and forevermore. In the name of our Son, Jesus. Amen.